Welcome to Elite Wrestling Radio. My name's Hotshot Danny Duggan, and this is CWE's first podcast, our first edition, and I'm very excited to have everyone here as I'm going to stumble and fumble my way through as I try to figure out our new format and kind of put this together on the go. I'm very excited to do something like this. I'm usually the interviewee. I've done many interviews on radio and many podcasts over the years as a professional wrestler myself, but I've never been on the other end of the microphone trying to piece it all together. So bear with me, and we'll get through this. We've got a lot of good stuff on deck tonight. We're going to talk about some of the ongoing and happenings in Canadian Wrestling's Elite. And to finish off the podcast, we've got a very in-depth interview, the first of its kind, with 17-year Canadian wrestling veteran Mentolo, who I'm going to sit down with and ask some fun questions to so people can get to know the man behind the mask. So as we get started here, I just want to give some people a briefing on what we're going to be doing here. Essentially, this is an open format to everything that is CWE. So we're going to talk about the live events that are coming up. We're going to talk about CWE TV. And most importantly, we're going to start talking to some of the stars of CWE and some of the stars that have been to CWE and get you a little more familiar with them behind the camera. So we have a lot going on right now, from the tours to the television to our ongoing growth in social media. It was the natural step for Canadian Wrestling's Elite to take a jump into the podcast world. It's something I've just been introduced to the last little while through other wrestlers' podcasts and things of that nature. I'm not very technology inclined. I know how to use my Facebook. I know how to use my email. But I've been getting more involved with online technology like podcasts and things of that nature. And it's something I'm very excited to give a shot to for the first time. So rolling along, for those that will follow CWE as a live event wrestling company, we've got a big event coming up on January 17th at Rookie Sports Bar. Now, this is something that started off as a trial run. We were asked by the Rookie Sports Bar, I believe it was last July, it was sometime in the summer, if we'd be interested in doing professional wrestling out of the Central Hotel. And to be honest with you, upon first request, it was something that I was a little wishy-washy about. I wasn't sure it was a right fit for CWE and where the company was going. But we thought, you know, it'd be another opportunity for wrestlers to get in the ring and hone their craft. And I'm very big on wrestlers getting in the ring as much as they possibly can to get as good as they can at what they do. So I said, you know what, let's give it a shot. Let's see what we can make of this. And here we are going into January 17th, which will be our fifth event. And each and every month since they've started in January, we've done some once a month or bi-monthly. The crowd has grown each and every time. And we just did a show a few weeks ago, December 27th, and it was 2 days after Christmas. I figured we were going to have a very quiet, lonely Rookie Sports Bar for all the boys to drink their woes away with there being no audience. But it packed the place, and it was the busiest event we've had since we started at Rookie. So the loyal CWE audience is really giving us a go and a good time at Rookie Sports Bar. So we're returning on January 17th, And with that, we've got what's going to be the biggest main event to take place at Rookie Sports Bar to date, and that is the first ever meeting between the Big Sexy Beast and Man. That's Blake Broadway and Mr. Incredible, and this is a match that I'm going to take a seat at the back of the bar after my match is done and enjoy as a wrestling fan, because these are two fantastic teams. These aren't two guys that are thrown together performing a tag team match that night. These are two established tag teams, the Big Sexy Beast being the most dominant tag team in Western Canada for the last 10 years, and the upstart team of the brothers Blake Broadway and Mr. Incredible. So that's going to headline the Rookies event January 17th. Full event details are on our website at cwecanada.ca, and that's a match I'm very much looking forward to. Blake Broadway is someone who came to CWE earlier this year. He actually debuted on our first event at Rookie Sports Bar and blew us away. We knew we were getting somebody with talent and ability, but he really blew us away with the match he had with AJ Sanchez. That was one of my favorite of the year 2013. I think Blake Broadway is a man who has a ton of potential to do a lot of big things in this business. He's got a good look. He's got a great attitude. He has natural charisma, and something that's very important to me as I can relate to it. He's a student of professional wrestling. He's always asking questions. He's always studying professional wrestling, and he's always trying to get better. I mean, you have someone like that in your locker room, it raises the game of everybody, especially when you have to get in the ring in there and work with them. And that's very much the case for somebody like AJ Sanchez and his partner, Kevy Chevy. So this is going to be a big-time tag match. Get on out. Make sure to get a ticket for Rookie Sports Bar, because this is going to be one of those matches that we're posting as one of the Match of the Year candidates at the end of 2014. Also signed on that night, yours truly, Hotshot Danny Duggan, for the first time, I think in close to 10 years, will be getting in the ring with Darren Dalton in singles action. And it's been a nice 10 years since I've had to get in the ring with Darren Dalton, and I'm probably going to hope it's another 10 after that, because Darren is one of the hardest hitting men I've ever been in the ring with. And at 270 pounds, he throws you around in ways that most men can't. So I'm looking forward to the opportunity 10 years later and 50 pounds heavier to get in the ring with Darren and try to handle myself a little bit better. But I know I'm going to be waking up sore regardless of the result come Saturday morning. So that's what's on deck for Rookie Sports Bar. Stay tuned to the website. There's going to be many more match announcements as the days goes on and we get closer and closer to the January 17th event here in Winnipeg. In the meantime, tune in this Friday night. CWE TV is back on the air. You know, we're going into episode 62 now, I do believe, episode 62, 63. So we're really, really gaining some traction with our television product. And on this Friday night's edition, you're going to see Tyler Colton returning from his stay in Texas and his experience with the Texas Wrestling Academy, training with WWE star Funaki, as this will be his first match back since returning from Texas. And he's going to be wrestling first All-Star Brian Rich, both these men with training by Mentolo under their belt. So it's going to be a very interesting dynamic as these two former classmates go head-to-head. Also, the heated rivalry that is Man, that same tag team we just talked about moments earlier, will get in the ring with Thunderblood. If you've been watching weeks and weeks of CWE TV, this has been escalating with Man most recently trying to take out Thunderblood with a hammer. So things are getting a little more serious, they're getting a little more hot and heavy, and these two teams are going to collide again after their last encounter, leading to a double countout. Also, on CWE TV, a match I'm very much look forward to seeing, Kamikaze wrestling AJ Sanchez. Kamikaze, another great athlete, very much like Blake Broadway I talked about earlier, just an absolute pleasure to have a part of CWE. Somebody who eats, sleeps, and breathes professional wrestling, constantly on the road, living the life of a traveling wrestler, trying to up his game at each and every opportunity. And he gets in there with somebody with the ability of AJ Sanchez, which is going to guarantee for a fantastic match on CWE television. That's on MTS Channel 30, Bell Express View Channel 592, across Canada. And of course, you can watch live on NACTV.ca. So that's what's going on this week in Canadian Wrestling's Elite. Let's look forward to the future. CWE's fifth anniversary show is right around the corner as we celebrate 5 years of Canadian Wrestling's Elite. And this show and tour, is being headlined by the debut of former WWE superstar, the Masterpiece, Chris Masters. It feels surreal to think that we're 5 years into operating Canadian Wrestling's Elite. I was just speaking with AJ Sanchez the other day, and it feels like it was just yesterday. We're sitting down trying to put this together, the blind leading the blind, really trying to figure out how to get an operation off the ground, and to see how it's grown over 5 years, not only in the Winnipeg market, which is absolutely amazing for us now with such consistent, great audiences, but when you think about all the talent that has come through CWE in the last 5 years, from all the big-name import talents that have come in, from all the top independent stars from across Canada and the U.S. that have come to CWE, it's something that's become really, really special. And in that 5 years, we've had the ability and fortunate opportunity to perform in three different provinces in over 30 different cities. CWE's been on the road throughout Manitoba, northwestern Ontario, Saskatchewan, and now we're back on the road touring again, so the sky's the limit. And along that way, we picked up CWE TV. So this thing just keeps on rolling and getting bigger and bigger. And the fifth anniversary show is going to be a celebration. And what a way to celebrate with the debut of someone the caliber of Chris Masters. Go to our website, cwecanada.ca. Match announcements are probably going to start within the next week, week or two. And there's going to be many of them because we're not only running the fifth anniversary show in Winnipeg on February 21st, we are running a five-day tour. So we're going to return to Neepawa on the 19th. We're going to make our first return to Morden in close to a year on the 20th. We have Winnipeg on the Friday, Selkirk on the 22nd, and our return to Bossier on the 23rd. So the CWE brand is getting out there. It's getting out there heavy in many of these markets, and we're looking to make 2014 a year to remember. So now that we've got all the fun show information out of the way and some of the stuff that's going on in Canadian Wrestling's Elite, we're going to get former CWE champion and tag team champion Mentolo on the line for an exclusive first ever in-depth interview with the veteran. And now it is time for the first interview on Elite Wrestling Radio. On the line right now, I have former CWE champion and 17-year Canadian wrestling veteran, Mentolo. Welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me, Danny.
Now, Mentolo, you are someone behind the mask who's been very, very quiet throughout your 17 years, and this is going to be the first in-depth interview and look into your career. Are you ready to speak up and let yourself be heard?
Well, I'll do my best. You know, I usually don't do too many interviews, especially blogs and vlogs and stuff like that. So I'm ready here. Give it a go. Let's see what happens.
Let's see how much trouble we can get you in. So 17 years, you've covered a lot of ground. You've covered the entire country of Canada, the United States. You've wrestled internationally. So I think it's only best we start with where you started in professional wrestling. Let's get a little bit of a background on what intrigued you to get involved with professional wrestling and how you went about living that dream.
All right. Well, when I was in high school, I was on a basketball team, grade 12-year basketball, and my coach was a bit of a nimrod. You know, he'd play favorites to certain players that wasn't getting any playing time, and I wasn't about to sit the bench, so I quit. And from there, I needed another sport to get into. So I was kind of looking between, either kickboxing or professional wrestling. And my brother and myself, as little kids, we always used to wrestle around. And, you know, friends and family would be like, oh, what you guys are doing looks exactly like TV. So from there, walking through Portage Place Mall, and I noticed a poster for live professional wrestling. And at the bottom it says, if you want to get involved, call this number. So went home, called the number. And next thing you know, that Sunday, I was at the training center having my first session in training.
And who was that first session of training with?
First session of training was with my original trainer, Vance Nevada.
Now, what can you tell us about some of your early memories of training? Is it something that came naturally to you, or is it something that took some time for you to adapt to and get used to?
Well, I would say, you know, it was pretty tough because, coming from basketball, you do a lot of running. So I wasn't a very big guy. I was probably, 140. And, it was in the dead of winter, so the ring is extremely stiff because it's in a cold garage. So bumping and stuff like that was very taxing on my body, you know. It's almost like bones, you know, bumping on wood. So it was very, very strenuous.
And how long did you partake in the training before you made your official debut?
I believe I trained for 6 months when I made my debut. I believe it was in July of 1997.
And who was the lucky participant as your opponent on that night?
That lucky participant was none other than JT Atlas, also known as Andy Anderson, my very first match.
Wow. So when you first debuted with JT Atlas, were you wrestling under a mask, or is that something that came to be as time went on?
No, I sure was under a mask. I either wrestled as like Black Panther or Black Magic or something like that.
Now, was it your decision to wrestle under a mask when you debuted, or is that something that was bestowed upon you by the promoter and booker at the time?
No, it was absolutely my 100% idea.
And what inspired that?
Before I got into wrestling, I was really big into, in high school, I started getting into Japanese wrestling. And obviously, guys like Jushin Liger, Ultimo Dragon, Great Sasuke, those guys were very much my inspiration to wear the mask.
Now, you say that your inspiration...
Wait, Danny. Before we go on, let me just also say, another reason I chose to wear the mask was to avoid black stereotypes, meaning I didn't want the promoter telling me that I need to come out with a ghetto blaster or I need to come out with a bag of drugs or something stupid like that. I wanted the fans to watch me for my wrestling ability and not, have preconditioned stereotypes from the promoter.
Now, when you talk about that potential discrimination, thinking back at the wrestlers that were active at the time in Winnipeg, I can't recall another black wrestler. Were you the first, and did you face any racial discrimination while breaking into the business?
At that time, I don't think there were any other black wrestlers. And, you know, there probably were times. There were times when, you know, race was a little bit of a factor.
Is there any incidences that stand out in your mind that may have pointed that?
Well, you know, a lot of it is he said, she said, but, you know, there were, like, wrestlers, you know, using racial slurs, not directly to my face, but you get the through the grapevine, like, this wrestler said this about you, stuff like that.
Now, in 1997, the internet really hadn't blown up with wrestling. It was getting there. It was definitely on its way. As somebody who was just breaking into the business, never mind in the business yet, how did you come across Japanese wrestling, and what stood out to you that drew your interest in to kind of devote and your career and style of professional wrestling to that genre, opposed to the American style of professional wrestling that you grew up on your whole life?
Well, I had a friend in high school who was ordering ECW tapes. And he was lending me those, and, you know, it was crazy, the stuff you were seeing with Sabu, and Cactus Jack was there, and Sandman, all these barbed wire matches and stuff. And then he proceeded to lend me the IWA King of the Deathmatch tournament from 1995. And, you know, many people have seen that on TV with all the exploding barbed wire and stuff like that. And then what really started to get me into it is he lent me New Japan Pro Wrestling's Battle Formation from 97, which, you know, it had Liger and Great Sasuke in the opener, but it also had, like, Lex Luger versus Chono. The Steiner brothers were on there. The Road Warriors were on there. Great Muda versus Hakushi. So what helped was seeing the Americans integrated with the Japanese guys. Then it helped me to learn the Japanese guys, and then, you know, I was really impressed with them. So from there on, I just started watching more and more, and then I started ordering my own tapes.
So obviously that style was very influential on your career. In 1997 in the city of Winnipeg, that style of professional wrestling was definitely unheard of. So how was it, as you developing as a young performer, trying to integrate this style of professional wrestling into a very traditional wrestling town with very basic yay-boo professional wrestling here in the city of Winnipeg?
It was pretty tough because, for instance, at the time there was Robbie Royce and Vance Nevada, who were sort of like the junior heavyweights, and I guess JT Atlas too. But they were doing more like WWF high-flying style, like, say, 1-2-3 Kid or, you know, Shawn Michaels, Marty Jannetty, that type of stuff. So trying to implement, like, elements of Japanese or Lucha Libre was very tough because, you like, there was no understanding of those type of things. Like, at that time, in the local wrestling scene, the only tape that was really being passed around was a Great Muda tape. And, you know, guys hadn't, you know, there were no guys really doing, like, maybe Robbie Royce was doing, like, backflips or moonsaults and stuff, but there was, other than that, there was nothing else. There were no, like, head scissors, there were barely any hurricanranas, there was none of that other stuff. So it was very tough to portray a certain style when the style here was absolutely different.
So when you would get in the ring with wrestlers, you know, much larger than yourself that weren't accustomed to the style of professional wrestling yet, was there a styles clash, or did you adjust to the Canadian style of professional wrestling to make the match work?
Well, you kind of have to adjust. And because the majority here is doing it, you kind of have to adjust your style to incorporate that style as well. It, you know, it's very tough to pull off certain things. It's sort of like if you have two MMA guys, and how do I explain it without eating up too much time? It was very difficult to implement, you know, the Japanese style when everyone here was doing North American.
So at the time, you were working for the Canadian Wrestling Federation, and the owner and promoter at the time was a man named Ernie Todd, who's a very controversial figure in Canadian wrestling and professional wrestling as a whole. What can you tell us about breaking in under Ernie Todd and any experiences you may have had with him?
To be honest with you, when I broke in, I didn't have much interaction with him. A lot of my dealings were through Vance, and, you know, if anything needed to be relayed, he would be the guy to go to.
So it wasn't too long after you debuted, maybe about a year or two later, you made the jump to River City Wrestling. What fueled that decision to make your first jump from one company to another, one of which would be many throughout your career, but this was the first one that happened. What led you to make that decision, and what were the ramifications?
Actually, the first jump I made was from CWF to Power Pro Wrestling, the Vance Nevada, Steve Stryker, Bugsy Slug upstart. And the reason behind my departure was, you know, pretty much my trainer was going there, and you know, I didn't want to be stuck in limbo, and I didn't know what the future of Canadian Wrestling Federation was. All I knew was that this is the way my trainer is going. It's probably in my best interest to follow him.
So Power Pro Wrestling, that didn't last very long. So you had to go back to the CWF. Was that held against you for making the jump and coming on back, or was it smooth sailings upon your return?
No, it was absolutely held against me. You know, when we came back, there were the contract to be signed, and you had to have the quote-unquote match with the Iron Man.
And for those at home, that is the infamous Ernie Todd.
Yes, it is.
So what can you tell us about this match you had to have with Iron Man?
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't think other guys had to have it. Obviously, I was a much smaller guy, so it was kind of easier to, you know, manhandle me. And I don't want to give the impression he beat me up or anything like that. But obviously, he picked and chose his spots when things were, you know, were a little bit above and beyond, I guess you could say.
So it wasn't long after that you then made the jump to River City Wrestling. What fueled that decision? Was it the politics and the things of that nature that were held against you for making that initial jump, or was it just time to make a change?
Well, you know, Wayne started River City, and you know, like all of Don's trainees were there: Donnie DiCaprio, you know, Playboy Will Damon, obviously, and you know, Don Callis was even doing certain appearances there as well to kind of help his guys out. So I kind of felt like, you know, this was a company that had younger guys, guys more my size, maybe guys who are sort of willing to change their style or learn a different style or, you know what I mean, just have the same kind of mentality as myself, whereas CWF was still a lot of old school mentality. So I wanted to be with guys who were sort of more like-minded. Obviously, you know, later on there was Johnny Malibu, Ronnie Attitude, Big O, Moses Luke. So these are all young guys who I kind of felt like this is where I should be probably. It's probably best for my interest.
So you went from being the rookie on a crew of a lot of established Manitoba wrestling wrestlers to a crew of upstarts. And you mentioned a lot of those names that went on to do some really good things here in the province of Manitoba and beyond. What was it like coming into a locker room where now you, being only 2 years into the business, are now the senior to a good majority of the locker room?
Well, you know, it was okay because a lot of the guys trained with Stan Saxon, so they had a good base and, you know, fundamentals were pretty decent, so it was a lot easier working with them, and sort of they were more open to different styles of wrestling, whereas, you know, CWF guys are stuck in their ways, so good luck trying to, you know, try to convince someone of something else.
Is there anyone specifically from that original class when you went over that you took a liking to, that you preferred working with, that you saw potential in, that took more of a liking to the style you were trying to implement at the time?
Probably the most, like, the guy I saw the most potential in at the time was probably Ronnie Attitude. And I'm speaking before Kenny Omega came around, obviously. You said the original crew. Probably Ronnie Attitude and then Johnny Malibu.
So as River City Wrestling, this is when I first started to get involved with local wrestling. I was 12, 13 years old, going to Chalmers Community Club, and I was a part in a very small scale as this operation was starting to take force here and come together. And it seemed to be mounting a whole lot of momentum. And at the snap of a finger, just many months later, it was all gone as Wayne Stanton sold to the Canadian Wrestling Federation and your old boss, Ernie Todd. What was your feeling upon hearing this news, and how did you take it?
Well, at first I was kind of worried a little bit that, you know, things were just going back to the old ways that they used to be. But there wasn't a long period of time before Bobby J made the offer to start a new promotion. So it wasn't like there was like months and months of mulling things over, like, oh, where am I going to end up and what's going to happen now? And, you know, for a certain amount of time period, I was even in the Maritimes wrestling out there. So thankfully, Bobby J stepped in and kind of took over the promotion.
So how did that come about? So Wayne Stanton makes the announcement to the crew that Ernie Todd is buying River City Wrestling and it's going to merge into one operation. How did it come about that Bobby J was going to start an operation, and how did everybody agree to be a part of that new upstart? Did he call a meeting? Did he call everyone individually? What was the process to getting that crew together?
I'm pretty sure that Bobby called a meeting. I think that Bobby was tired of working for the CWF as well. And I'm pretty sure that he called a meeting because I remember all the guys being at the training center. I'm pretty sure it was the training center anyways. And him saying, like, you know, you guys can go back, or if you don't want to, like, I'm going to start up this promotion, and guys don't have to go back. Because I think that CWF and Ernie Todd were under the assumption that because they bought the ring from Wayne and whatever other assets, that this would include the roster as well. However, I believe that, you know, very few guys went to work with for Ernie, and most of the guys stayed with Bobby or, you know, continued to wrestle there.
Did Ernie Todd reach out to you or his booker at the time about coming back to the merged operation?
He personally didn't reach out to me. He may have reached out to other wrestlers. I know, like, I'm pretty sure Rob Stardom went to work there, maybe Mark Manson at the time. However, I don't recall him reaching out to me, and I don't really recall him anyone else saying in the locker room, like, you know, I received a call from Ernie Todd or anything like that.
So River City Wrestling merges with the CWF. Bobby J is starting Top Rope Championship Wrestling. It's a fresh start. This crew has never worked with Bobby J before. You're going up against the established promotion, pretty much running in the exact same neighborhood and at one point the same venue as the CWF. What was the train of thought with the new upstart company? Was it hopeful that there was going to be potential, or was it take it day by day and see where this goes?
I think it was more take it day by day, and I think it was that the two products were very different. You know, we were much younger. We were trying to do, like, a different style of wrestling, especially with the junior heavyweights, trying to do something a little bit more exciting. You know, like, say, for instance, Nitro was very big at the time, and their cruiserweight division was very big. And we were trying to be that sort of style and like, have that type of energy, whereas I think the CWF, they were going more, brawling and bruisers and maybe, like, more of the extreme ECW type of style. So, you know, it was very much different products.
Now, if anything, one of the most notable things, maybe the most notable thing to happen in the history of Top Rope Championship Wrestling, is it's where the now world-renowned Kenny Omega made his debut into professional wrestling. What are your earliest memories of Kenny coming into Top Rope Championship Wrestling, and did you take a liking to him right away, or is this something that developed over time?
No, I took a liking to him right away. You know, he came in and, like, he had a background in hockey, and, you know, you could just see his athleticism. He's a super athletic guy, really good kid when he came in, you know, pretty quiet, but you could see he had a grasp on wrestling. Maybe still going into his body, if anything. Like, if there was something negative that I had to find to say about him, it would be that. But, you know, like, you could just see the athletics, and you could see that he had a huge future ahead of him.
Now, he credits you as his trainer. He did have his initial training with the likes of Vance Nevada, but he credits you as the person that trained him and kind of mentored him to where he got to where he is now. Is this something that you did personally one-on-one in a training center, or is it something you just did in the locker room before and after matches, or do you think that's attributed to working with him directly in the ring?
You know, he says that all the time, and I've discussed it with him. I'm like, when did this happen? What are you talking about? And then he remembers clearly, like, oh, I was down at the training center this time, like, helping him with things. And I don't remember it. But I guess if he's willing to give me the credit, maybe I should take it. But I don't know. You know, a lot of his stuff, he learned on his own. And he's a natural talent. And I probably shouldn't take credit for it. But since he's going to give it to me, I'll just take it.
So you're talking about the junior heavyweight style of wrestling. And Top Rope Championship Wrestling definitely had a good handful of those with yourself. Kenny Omega, Ryan Wood, Ronnie Attitude. There were many great junior heavyweight wrestlers at the time in the city of Winnipeg. And as you mentioned, the CWF was a lot of larger men doing brawling, doing hardcore. But along came two men, Ross Skills and Chad Tatum, that formed the team of Assisted Suicide. And before you knew it, the CWF had two really exciting junior heavyweights as well. And because of the war at the time, it was very often compared, Ross Skills, Chad Tatum, to Kenny Omega and Mensalo on the other side of the fence. What are your memories of those comparisons, and do you think they were right?
No, I didn't think they were right at all. I thought these guys came along, and they were having good matches with Team Impact, Royce and Dalton, and, like, all these tables and chairs and stuff like that. But I don't think that, you know, at that time, I didn't feel like they were on the same level as us. I didn't think they could touch us at all. So I didn't think there was any type of comparison, and I didn't see why, like, just because a guy can do a backflip or a swanton, all of a sudden that means they're in the same category. Like, you know, it just kind of blew my mind that people thought, oh, well, here's the instant comparison, when there was none in my mind.
So was there an unsaid rivalry between the junior heavyweights in each promotion, or was this something that was more fabricated than anything?
Probably more fabricated, because I went to the show where Sabu no-showed, and I think that was my first time seeing seeing Skills and Tatum in action. And, you know, aside from that, it wasn't like, you know, each company was on TV to really watch each other and, you know, feel a certain way. So I would say a lot of that stuff was fabricated. I just felt like they weren't better than me, and I didn't feel like they were better than Omega either.
Well, it wasn't too long after that till, just like every other situation in Winnipeg wrestling, guys make the jump on over and join a new company. And that was the case with Assisted Suicide. They came along with Team Impact and many others. But it wasn't long after those comparisons were being made, they were now in the same locker room as you. What was your mindset as those two came into the locker room? Was a friendship formed right away, or was there a rivalry due to the fabrication that was made up by fans at the time? And how did things develop from there?
No, you know what? When they came in, you know, everyone was cool. And, you know, speaking with them and stuff like that, everybody was cool. It was no problems. You know, I believe they came over when it was PCW. No, they were there for TRCW, my bad. But I just kind of felt like the bookers at that time had a good, like, a match that people were probably, or some of the fans were anticipating to see, which was, like you said, Assisted Suicide versus Omega and Mentolo. And I kind of felt like, you know, the bookers probably dropped the ball on that a little bit. And it probably could have been built up a little bit more. But then at that point in time, the junior heavyweights weren't really a focus of either promotion.
Was it something that was just shotgunned and thrown together?
Yeah, you know, the first night in, they shotgunned Assisted Suicide versus myself and Ronnie Attitude. And I really think, like, it could have been built up so much more. You know, they had hot angles on top with, you know, with the heavyweights at that time. But there was just no focus on the junior heavyweight division, which, you know, it could have made the whole card top to bottom, like, meaningful.
So when they came over and you started working with them, was there any problem? They came in, they were the top junior heavyweights from another company. Was there any trouble putting matches together with them at the time, or was there instant chemistry, or did it take some time to develop over time? Because it is very storied that yourself and the likes of Ross Skills, Chad Tabe, and Omega have had some of the best matches in this province's history. Is that something that came easily, or is it something that was built over time?
No, it was all good matches right off the hop. You know, everyone, like, it was competition, obviously, because, you know, we're all teams and stuff like that, but, you know, it was good chemistry for the matches.
Well, it wasn't long after that till you had to make yet another decision, as at the time, wrestling promotions were popping up left, right, and center in the city of Winnipeg, and that was the case with an upstart company called Premier Championship Wrestling, and you were a part of a well-documented mass defection of a large majority of the Top Rope Championship Wrestling crew making the decision to go to the upstart PCW operation. What influenced your decision to leave?
You know, they had the big meeting. You know, they're going to start up this new company. It's going to be the best wrestling promotion in the world. There's going to be chrome turnbuckle posts and, like, all these, like, unrealistic promises. And so they had the meeting, and, you know, not as the leader of the group, but I kind of felt like I had the most experience. So I said to these guys, like, myself, Skills, Omega, and Tatum, like, we should really consider what is going on here and what our position in the company is going to be. Because I kind of felt like at the time, it could potentially be the MVP show, Madison, Damon, DiCaprio. And I didn't want to get lost in the shuffle. I thought we were all too talented to just, like, be the back seat. You know, I thought that this would be a good opportunity for us to shine. Now, whether that was in PCW or TRCW, you know, it's fine, but we should consider, like, what are we really doing here? And if, you know, Vance was still with TRCW, Mike Angels was there, and Bobby J was still going to continue to run wrestling. So, you know, we should really consider if the jump we're making is, you know, going to be a detriment or if it's going to be a benefit.
And is this a conversation you had directly with Mike Davidson at the time of the PCW startup?
No, I specifically actually had it with the other three guys. And, you know, we hadn't given our decision, or at least I hadn't. I don't know if those three had. But they were kind of like, oh, we need to know if everybody's on board. We need to know if everyone's on board. So I was kind of, you know, on the fence. I wasn't really sure. And then it wasn't until Vance called me, and he's like, I need to know what your decision is, whether you're going or staying. And, you know, I really hadn't decided yet, but I kind of felt like the way he worded it sort of, like, pushed me to be like, well, I guess I'm leaving then. What I was really hoping for was that there could be a sit down with Bobby J, and, you know, we could figure things out and maybe, you know, re-talk what our deals could be and stuff like that. But it didn't seem like there was any going down that road. So I was like, well, you know, if these three guys are going, then I may as well just go with them.
So if that phone call conversation was handled a little bit differently, we could be looking at a completely different history of Winnipeg Wrestling as you would have stayed with Top Rope Championship Wrestling.
I would like to think so, but, you know, who knows? I don't know if Top Rope really did good business after that, so it may not have made a difference whether we stayed or not.
Now, you mentioned that Vance Nevada did stay with Top Rope Championship Wrestling. Guys like Johnny Malibu, things of that nature, did as well. These are guys that you had personal connections with. Like, Vance was your original trainer. So what was going through your mind as you were leaving your initial trainer in the dust to go for this hot new startup? Did that have any personal ramifications, or was that something that was left on a professional level?
Well, I think that, you know, it's easy to say that nothing is personal or, like, you know, separate business and personal, but, you know, I think that I don't know specifically Vance, but I'm sure that, you know, there were kind of hurt feelings on both sides, and probably based on the way we handled it more than anything else. If we were a little bit more professional, maybe, you know, said to Vance, like, this is what's going on, you know, like, what do you think? But I guess, there were, like, the whole way PCW came about was everything was very much underhanded. So, you know, it was just another sort of a nail in the coffin, I guess you could say.
So you make the decision to go to PCW. It's the hottest girl in the bar. It's going to have this big money. It's going to be taking over professional wrestling. What was your faith in the vision that was laid out to you? You mentioned this meeting with the chrome turnbuckles, and they were going to be doing all these big things. How much faith did you have in them living up to the word they put out, to the scale of wrestling they were going to operate?
Not much, because I had heard those pitches before. Oh, it's like, you know, I heard it with Power Pro. It's going to be the next big thing, and blah, blah, blah. We're going to have this, and distribution, and TV, and yada, yada, yada. Like, I had heard it before, so... I was pretty sure that this company was built for three guys. So I wasn't, like, you know, a deer in headlights or anything like that.
So you didn't have any faith in the vision from the day it started?
I wouldn't say I didn't have faith in it, but I wasn't drinking the Kool-Aid either. You know, a lot of guys were like, oh, this is going to be so great because this guy's a millionaire back in the company and all that kind of stuff. And I was kind of more, well, show me results first before we start, you know, before this is the new WWF or anything like that.
Okay, so you wanted to see results. They kick off with their debut show in the city of Winnipeg. They draw 1,500 people to the University of Manitoba with a huge show headlined by the late Eddie Guerrero, the Honky Tonk Man, Brutus Beefcake. What's going on in your mind as you're in a locker room getting ready to go out in front of the biggest audience you've ever worked from? Are you starting to drink the Kool-Aid then?
Well, you know, we did the show, though. We did the first show, actually, was in, like, what, Minnedosa or something like that, which really didn't draw that well. So, I mean, but to answer your question, you know, I was like, well, this is a great start. This is a great start. But where we, like, the place is packed and the crowd is going crazy, and we, you know, Kenny and I have a really good match. And then it's like, okay, you know, this is great. That night, everything's going good. And then it's where we going from here now.
Not to fast track ahead of that night, but going back to that night, I remember being around the business at the time, there was a lot of talk about who was going to get that match with Eddie Guerrero. And there was a lot of talk that it was going to be Kenny Omega, it was going to be Mentolo, but it ultimately ended up being Playboy Will Damon. And he's someone you mentioned that was around that MVP cornerstone that the company was going to be built around. Did you think he was a suitable opponent with where the company envisioned itself going, or did you feel you were passed up for an opportunity you deserved?
Well, there was a lot of things like, oh, Eddie doesn't want to work with junior heavyweights. And, you know, just very, very stories like that. And you know what? That's fine. It really didn't bother me. did I feel like I was passed up? Potentially. But it wasn't a sore spot with me. Like, I think Will Damon's a great wrestler, or at least he was a great entertainer. So I didn't foresee it being a big problem. Plus, I was working with Kenny Omega. It's not like I got stuck working. I don't know. Throw any potential name in there if you want.
So,
you know, it wasn't like I had a bad opponent to work with.
So you wrestle in front of 1,500 people. You and Kenny Omega tear down the house at the University of Manitoba. Things are looking great. How long after that, with no follow-up until the summer with the next big show at CanWest Global Ballpark, did you see maybe this isn't going to go as big as I thought it was and start to realize maybe it was going to be small scale like the other things you had done?
Well, they did. Okay, so they did the big show, and then I guess they still had Honky and Beefcake in town, so they do the show at the Lid, which is obviously, as you know, it's a huge drop-off from, what, 1,500 or, you know, whatever the real number is, 13 or 12 or whatever, to, what, 200-300 in the bar? You know, it's a huge, huge drop-off. And then kind of when you start to know, like, oh, maybe this isn't, you know, going to be as big as they think it is when you start running the bar weekly, you know, up until that show at the CanWest Park.
Did that change your attitude going to work every week, or was it, well, this is what we got, let's make the best of it?
Well, you know, kind of both. Like, I wouldn't say it changed my attitude, but I was like, well, you know, this is what I expected. You know, I kind of knew, like, I was, like I said, I wanted the results. And these guys, you know, were just running the bar. So I was kind of like, well, you know, that's kind of what I expected. But, you know, it didn't make me go out there and work any less hard or anything like that.
So,
but I wasn't like, oh my God, I'm so surprised. Like, why are we here every week? Like, we were promised, you know, stadiums and stuff. Like, maybe some guys were, but I wasn't.
So it wasn't long after that the show at CanWest Global Ballpark happened, and that drew some decent business for the company as well. But shortly after, Mike Davidson, one of the original founders of the company, decided to depart ways with PCW. What can you recall about the locker room environment and reaction to that?
You know what? I told the bookers and all, like, whoever was in charge of PCW, I told them, do not run the ballpark. That show drew horribly. You know, it was probably the biggest detriment to the company was running the ballpark. We nowhere near filled that building. It was a huge waste of money. And, you know, like, that's probably what sort of led to the split, I would assume, of Mike Davidson from PCW. Now, was there a lot of, like, backlash and, like, what was the attitude at the time? I think that certain guys, there was probably starting to become a division, and certain guys were with Mike and liked his ideas and his vision for the company, and maybe some, I don't know if some guys did. I think a lot of the times when you hear these stories, a lot of people make it seem like there was all this dissension and stuff like that. I think a lot of guys just showed up to wrestle, to be honest with you, and were there to wrestle and not play politics and not be like, oh, I support one guy's ideas over the other and all this kind of stuff. I think guys just wanted to wrestle, and they were happy to wrestle, and that's what their focus was.
Now, with Mike Davidson leaving, Andrew Shallcross took over the helm of the company. So obviously that meant a change of direction to the company. What are some of those changes that were made?
Well, with that, I think it sort of split a lot of fans, because I think a lot of fans were becoming, like, too personally involved in, you know, backstage politics. And I think that a lot of things really got split up. And I think that really, I think that hurt PCW. But, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry, what was your question, Dan? Let me answer that. Let me answer that again.
It was about the change of direction and your thoughts on that.
Yes. So obviously, now with a lot of guys gone, like, I believe a lot of the, like, at least DiCaprio was, I think DiCaprio was still there. Did DiCaprio go too? Do you remember, Danny?
I believe he stayed. I could be mistaken, but
I believe he stayed, but I think the other two left. So that sort of changed the whole focus, and sort of PCW became more junior heavyweight, Japanese oriented. And definitely the style of the show has changed to a more, like, athletic style of wrestling.
And that kind of leads into my next question is, depending on who you talk to and their version of the story, that there was this political rift in the locker room, that there was the entertainment style wrestlers at the time, and there was the junior heavyweight wrestlers at the time, and the entertainment wrestlers were pushed, and there was less of a focus on the junior heavyweight guys, that they were expected to go out there and work a certain style of match with no story behind them, while the guys on top got to do the easy stuff and the talking. Is this something that, once again, is fabricated by myth and legend, or was there a rift between the junior heavyweights and the guys working on top?
From my perspective, I don't really feel like I didn't really care what they were doing. I didn't feel like it had the story value behind it missing, but I think that our matches were action-packed, which is what they were missing. Now, I know a couple times they tried to amalgamate things or have like crossover or like, you know, certain juniors working with certain heavies, and I think that worked, but when it came down to it, like, the main angles and the main focus were always on the heavyweights.
Now, do you feel that the junior heavyweights could have been put in a top program at the time, or were they in the right spot with carrying the workload of the show on the undercard?
No, I absolutely believe that they could have done main events, and I think that, you know, like, for anyone who disagrees, you can easily just go back and watch the videos and see that the junior heavyweights are over. You know, instead of just going, like, we can say, like, oh, I say this, or this is my opinion, but really, if you sit there and watch the shows, you can see, you know, Ross Gills was super over, Omega was over, Tatum and Angels were over, I was over, and, you know, there's no reason that, there couldn't have been more spots at the top.
So from PCW, you started to then branch out into other areas of the country. You were very well traveled at that point. But a couple of years later, you made your first really big jump at an opportunity when you attended the Pro Wrestling NOAH camp. What made you decide to take the long trek down to Missouri? And what can you tell us about your experience there?
Well, you know what? Just to kind of finish off your last question there. If you look at, you've seen WrestleMania 3, obviously. If you look at that card, from top to bottom, there's angles and stories and stuff for pretty much every match. And there's no reason that, you know, not necessarily every match here has to have some sort of storyline or something behind it, because obviously WrestleMania 3 is the biggest show of the year. But there's no reason that you can't have little stories or little angles and stuff like that to make things meaningful to sell your matches, right? Because as a matchmaker, that's your biggest concern, is having things to draw fans in, obviously.
100%.
So there's no reason that, you know, obviously you want to put a match where two guys are gonna go in there and have a great match that the fans are gonna like, but it doesn't hurt to, you know, add layers to it as well. Now, as far as the NOAH camp, I decided to go there because I wanted to progress in wrestling. At this time, I was working Regina, or Saskatchewan, should I say, Manitoba, you know, Ontario. I had done the Maritimes. I had done North Dakota. But Japan was always a dream of mine. And this was the first. I had heard about it the previous year and did take an interest in it. But when I heard, like, Kobashi and Marufuji and Kenta and all these guys were coming down, and there was an opportunity to go to NOAH, you know, I jumped on, you know, going down there to really find out what was up.
And when you got there, what was up?
Well, you know, it was a 5-day camp, and there were a lot of guys from all over the states, and you know, myself and Omega were there. And, you know, it was very much, though, you know, a showcase for Harley's wrestlers. You know, which I guess is smarter on his part, but then it kind of hurts everyone else. But, you know, it was still a good learning opportunity. We were in the ring and, you know, got to make, you know, a little bit of connections. Obviously, that's the camp that Kenny Omega got signed out of. So I guess while I say it was a showcase for Harley's guys, you know, there still was the opportunity to get signed out of it.
Did you get any feedback specifically from the NOAH or WWE officials while you were there? That was you went back for a second year, did you not?
I sure did, yes.
And what can you tell us about your second year there?
Second year, I felt I did much better. You know, I thought my wrestling was tip top. I didn't think there was anyone in that camp who could touch me. You know, obviously I wasn't, you know, a huge, you know, monster like the Road Warriors or anything like that. But I thought that pound for pound, I was the best wrestler, had the best performances. And, you know, I still got passed up for, you know, Harley's guys.
Now, with that being said, you came back to Winnipeg, and it was shortly after that. I do believe it was after your second camp, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. You got what would probably be a dream match for you, I would imagine. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'd imagine would be a dream match opportunity with the Ultimo Dragon. What can you tell us about, upon hearing that news, that you'd get a chance to get in the ring with an international star of his caliber?
Well, so it must have been after the NOAH camp. I went to Mexico in 2008. And I think I did that NOAH camp maybe 2006 or 7. So then I went to Mexico for about 3 months. And then when I came back to PCW, I'm guessing AWE or WFX, one of those two companies, brought in Ultimo. And he was on loan to PCW. So, you know, I was very much excited as, you know, I met Ultimo in Mexico and, you know, went to his dojo and, you know, there was a barbecue there and all this kind of stuff. So regardless, I was excited to be in the ring with him and test my skills against him.
So you get the call, you're told you're going to be wrestling Ultimo Dragon, and this is a big opportunity because not only is it somebody that's catered to your style of professional wrestling, but it's somebody who's very influential in the international world of professional wrestling, both being connected in Mexico and Japan. You get there the day of the show, you're ready to get this going. Walk us through your experience from meeting Ultimo Dragon to the match itself.
Well, Ultimo, he spent most of the time up in his room because obviously the lid was attached to the Holiday Inn, so he was in his room most of the time. And, you know, I was very excited. Obviously, I was very nervous to work with him. And then when we when we had the match, it was terrible. It was, you know, just a brutal, brutal match. And, you know, it was my fault. But yeah, like it was probably one of the worst matches I've had.
Was it just nerves?
It was probably a combination of that and a combination of, like, you know, I learned all these new things in Mexico, and I know that he wrestled in Mexico, and I want to try them out and implement them. And it really hurt the match, and you know, probably. If there was any opportunities that Ultimo Dragon was giving out, like, he wasn't giving them to me, that's for sure.
What was his attitude towards you after the match going so poorly?
He's kind of a hard guy to read. He was kind of just like, oh, you know, whatever, things kind of happen or stuff like that. And, you know, he didn't really say much, which probably isn't positive at all.
Was this a very discouraging experience for you? Was it something you were able to learn from and pick up and move on from?
I really felt like I embarrassed myself, to be honest with you. It was very embarrassed from the match. But, you know, you either move on or you cry about it. So, you know, I did my best to kind of get over it and move on to the next one.
Am I wrong in saying that you ended up having a second match with him while you were in Japan?
I worked with him. We did a six-man tag where he was on my team. And then we did a mixed tag where I did work against him, which was a much better match. And I think, and judging from that match, I could tell that he wasn't happy with the one here and he was happy with the one there.
Okay, so he did remember the match in Winnipeg.
He did remember it, but his reaction after the match was much different.
Okay.
Yeah.
So before that match, you mentioned you went down to Mexico. How was that something that came about? Did you just pack up your bags and say, I'm going to give this a shot?
Just a vacation. I wanted to learn lucha. And, you know, I wasn't going to learn it here. And I was just kind of, you know, floating around, not really doing much. And, you know, I thought, well, I want to learn and I want to go on a vacation. So what better place to go than Mexico? So I started just researching, like, where the schools are and stuff like that. And I just, you know, bought my ticket and went.
So you showed up, wrestling gear in tow. Did you arrange this ahead of time of going, or did you show up at their door and say, I'm ready to learn?
Pretty much just showed up at the door, showed up in Mexico. Then, you know, I went to a show that Dark Angel was on, Sarah Stock, and she helped me get into a hotel that was much closer to the school I'd be training at. And she's like, show up here at this time. And from there, you know, I started training.
Did you work any shows on your first stint in Mexico, or was it strictly training?
I worked at the very end of my first stint. I think I was a little confused with how long you were allowed in the country, and I'm pretty sure I only had 3 months on my visitor's, like, permit or whatever, you want, visitor's visa or whatever. So I did work in Arena Coliseo on my first trip out.
So you came back, and you were located in Winnipeg for a little while longer, but you went back for a second trip to Mexico. Was that inspired by how well the first round went?
Yeah, when I was leaving the first time, they were like, yeah, when you come back, we'll get you a work visa, and, when you come back, you'll go back to training and all this type of stuff. So I came back home, I worked for a little bit to try to save up a little bit more money, and then from there, decided, like, after, because I know Mexico slows down for the winter season, so once that was over, I decided to go right back.
And what can you tell us about your second experience there? Was it as promising and as exciting as the first?
Half and half. It was very tough because a lot of the foreigners down there are brought in by someone. For instance, Mark Jindrak, Alex Kozlov, Rocky Romero, or maybe not Rocky, but Alex and Mark. They were brought in by Ultimo Dragon. So they essentially have someone going to the office and saying, hey, this guy's here, can you please use him? Whereas to go down just as a freelance and try to get a job and not know anyone and not really know any Spanish is a lot tougher.
But you did end up getting on some bigger events while you were there. Who went to the office and helped you with that?
Well, to be honest with you, I was doing the beginner class that Sarah got me into, but my trainer, Hijo de Gladiador, wasn't going to the office and speaking on my behalf. So from there, Alex Kozlov got me moved up to a different class, sort of like going from junior high to high school. And he got me in the high school class with Facanico, who was training at a different building, Arena Coliseo. And it was him that went to the office and started saying, like, hey, I got this guy here, this foreigner, he's good, can you take a look at him, and stuff like that. And, he was the one who helped kind of start getting me matches in Arena Mexico.
So you get the matches of Arena Mexico. It was shortly after those matches you decided to come back home. Was that a work visa issue, or did you just feel your time was up?
They kept telling me, like, we're going to get you a work visa. And I would go to the office and I would tell them, like, my time is starting to run out. But the problem was that Ultimo Dragon, he was running a show down there called Dragon Mania. So he brings over a lot of Japanese guys, which go under CMLL's visas. You can only have so many visas out compared to how many Mexican wrestlers they have in CMLL. They can only have so many foreigners. So there's only so many visa slots they can use. So at that time, Ultimo was bringing over Yutaka Yoshi and Kensuke Sasaki and stuff like that, Fujinami. So he took up a ton of the visas. So there was no way for me to be able to get a visa before I had to leave.
So the visa, or the time ran out, you had to come back, and you stayed back. What was the decision behind not returning to Mexico when time was up?
Well, I wasn't really getting a good vibe from the office. The first couple of matches I had in Arena Mexico were not very good. And I think a lot of the problem was language barriers and, just little things like that. However, the more I stayed down there, the better my Spanish became. And the more I spoke up for myself and interjected my ideas, I was teaming with two other Japanese guys, Okamura and Ohara. And at first, I was kind of letting them, tell me what I should do and where I should do it. Whereas, once we start to tag more, I needed to show my skills. And I said, well, I'm going to start doing my own thing and injecting my own moves and my thoughts and ideas because they're not helping me. So, my matches start to get better. However, there's so many wrestlers in CMLL that it's tough to get bookings. And especially as a foreigner, you don't have the connections. It's tough to get those outside bookings. And that's, you know, really where you make your money is from them seeing you on TV, then the outside promoters want to use you. So if you're not on TV, you're not going to get that outside work. So it's definitely, it's such a struggle and like such a political game. It's really tough.
So your time ran out in Mexico. You returned home. And if my clock is correctly, it wasn't too long after that that CWE decided it was going to give it a go and start up professional wrestling in the city of Winnipeg. And you were one of those guys that got a call to be on the initial show. What were your thoughts as you got this phone call? That phone call would have been for me and the offer to be on the first CWE event.
You know, it was very similar to when I jumped to like a TRCW or something like that, or even PCW in its early stages PCW in its early stages because Skills, Omega, and Tatum were there. CWE was sort of similar because it had younger guys who enjoyed like ROH or even Japanese or Mexican styles. And, you know, as yourself, Danny, you know, you were a young promoter and you were doing everything you could to promote your shows and get fans in there. And, you know, like, you know, you remember the first CWE show. It was like tons of hot chicks, tons of people in there. It was just a different type of atmosphere. And, you know, that's something that I want to be a part of as well.
So you made the decision to do the show, and it wouldn't come without controversy because your home promotion at the time didn't really appreciate your decision to go ahead and do that show, and you went and did it anyways. What can you tell us about going against the grain and going against those wishes of a promotion that had given you work for so many years?
You know, it's tough, too, because when AWE started, you know, they kind of contacted me to go over there. And I decided not to, you know, and you know, PCW did a lot of things for me, you know, putting me in the ring with Ultimo or Chris Sabin or Christopher Daniels, you know, and, you know, gave me a lot of opportunities and stuff like that. So it's very tough to, you know, go against someone who's done so much to help you out. But I think that a lot of the problems weren't like generated towards myself. I think there were a lot of outstanding kind of circumstances and politics and stuff like that, you know, that you kind of people get caught in the crossfire.
So you went ahead and made the decision, and if I recall correctly, you didn't even know about this before it went public. You were put into the main event of that initial show with Bryan Danielson, now known as Daniel Bryan in WWE, in one of the favorite matches I've ever had the privilege of watching live. What was your reaction to getting the nod for that match with Daniel Bryan?
You know, very much, you know, sort of like working with Ultimo, very, very nervous. You know, he's sort of, you know, world recognized as being the greatest wrestler on earth or whatever his slogan is, the best wrestler on earth. And, you know, it's these type of times that you really have to get in and test yourself and see where you're at. And so, you know, I was very, very, it's another match that I was very nervous about. Which is usually good, you know. Usually, if you're not nervous about a match, you're probably in the wrong business, or you know, there's something wrong with the match that you're in. So this is one of those times where you know it was something I was really looking forward to, and you know, I was very excited to work with a guy who does that style as well.
Now I recall, and I could be open and honest about this. You know, obviously, me as a promoter of our first event, I was a nervous wreck the day of. I've never ran a show of that scale with that kind of audience before. I'd definitely helped book events before, but I never ran my own. So when you're the promoter and booker and a wrestler on the show, you're wearing many hats and you're running around. And on that first show, I can be open and honest in saying it was terrible. Like the first show we had was really, really bad. And I remember standing behind the curtain and just watching awful match after awful match in front of a packed Maples Community Club that we worked really hard to fill up and going, wow, we could be done before we even get off the ground here. And your match with Daniel Bryan was about to begin. And I realized, you know what? What is done is done. I can't sit back and stress about what's happened tonight. So I'm just going to sit down and enjoy this as a fan. And I have never, that's one match that really stands out to me as one that I was able to just take in as a fan. I was just blown away. I was a kid in the front row again watching that match. It was so well executed and so well put together. and the crowd responded accordingly. Did it feel like that while you were having the match? Did you have those same vibes about it?
You know what? To be honest with you, I did actually. Like, I know that you're the promoter. You laid out the money, and you know when it comes to it in the end, like, you're if things sink, like, obviously it's your ship going down. However, I'm a passenger on that ship going down with it. So I did feel like, you know, there is a certain amount of pressure to, you have to go out there, and this is the first show, so you got to go out there and deliver a great match that's going to keep these fans coming back. And, you know, if your ship sinks, then I don't get to my destination either. So it's sort of like, you know, we're working hand in hand kind of thing. So definitely there was that type of pressure on me as well.
So the main event delivered, and it saved what I thought, like I said, was a very bad show up until that point. Your match with Daniel Bryan was fantastic, and it really did save us in the sense that people left talking about that match for a very, very long time, and it inspired what CWE would be for the next year, and it definitely solidified your position with the company, not only, you know, for that year, but period, and the direction it went. So from there, CWE continued to go the trend of top international workers who can get it done in the ring in our main events. And I think you main evented almost all of those shows that year against the likes of Nigel McGuinness, Claudio Castagnoli, who's now Antonio Cesaro, Tyler Black, who's now Seth Rollins, Austin Aries, who went on to be TNA World Champion. You were in with the who's who of independent and international wrestling at the time. What are some of your memories of working with some of those guys in 2009?
Well, you know, I remember the match we had yourself and myself against Nigel and AJ. And, you know, I thought that was a really, really great match. You know, Claudio, you know, that was another one where I took a loss because, you know, I know that he can do that lucha style. And, you know, I was very excited, and you know, I probably rushed things more than anything else. So if fans go back and see that match, you know, if it was bad, you know, that's all on me. At least I'm willing to admit it, you know.
I think you lucked out because that's one show that mysteriously vanished from the archives that I've never seen. So I think you're okay.
Oh, my God. I hope nobody finds it, too. But, yeah, you know what? Like, especially for that whole year, you know, I'm glad and I'm proud that I was in those main events. But every time going out, because it's still a brand-new company, and, you know, we're still trying to draw fans, and, you know, we're fresh on the market. You know, you can't, there's no night off. You, like, I always have to go out there and make sure, like, you know, go out there and give a good hard match or kill myself or whatever it takes, you know, to keep the fans coming back. So, like you said, like, you know, there were a lot of great guys that came through and, you know, I like that too, that it was a lot of ROH guys who, you know, guys were going to Japan and doing things. And, you know, there was definitely like a buzz about CWE and I was just proud to be a part of that. Like, the main guy, the figurehead, so to speak.
So as that year came to a close, it was very early in 2010, it became public knowledge you were going to Japan. This was something that I didn't know until it was announced publicly, and it was something I don't think very many, if anybody, knew other than yourself. How did the opportunity present itself to go over for Tajiri's Smash promotion? Was it something that was inspired by him coming here to Winnipeg, or was this something that was in the books before he got here?
To be honest, it was in the books before he got here. I believe that, you know, Tajiri was starting up his promotion, Smash, in Japan, and they were looking to find talent that, you know, that weren't popular on the indies or guys that weren't, you know, already in Japan. They weren't looking for ROH guys. They weren't looking for TNA. They wanted, you know, something new. So, you know, Andy, JT Atlas, Andy Anderson, worked with Tajiri in Japan. And I believe that Tajiri asked him if he could recommend some wrestlers. And, you know, by luck, you know, thank God, Andy, you know, pushed me to Tajiri, said, hey, check this guy out. And from there, you know, the Smash office got in contact with me about coming over and stuff like that, and, you know, sort of all in the books.
So you went there very early 2010. Do you feel that being the figurehead of a company in main events against the world class caliber talent you were, did that prepare you for going to Japan? Were you more confident making that move internationally with the matches you had done in the last year?
Absolutely. And I mean, the first thing was training in Mexico. I think that's helped me the most to be able to take my talent to a different level. And then on top of that, you know, working, being in the pressure cooker, you know, those main events, having to rely on my talents and abilities and stuff like that, you know, took me to another level. So all those things, you know, helped for my Japan trip, absolutely.
Now, you went to Japan and you had a good long run with Smash. What are some of your memories and some of your favorite matches you had while you were there?
You know, Tajiri, the first match with Tajiri, you know what? I worked with Tajiri here. You and I did a tag against him and Kushida. And I did the match against him for WFX. I remember Tajiri, he sunset flipped me. No, I sunset flipped him, and then he bridges out, and he hit me with a back kick or something like, or he ducked my clothesline, hit me with a back kick. And I swear to God, I almost thought he broke my jaw. He kicked me so hard. But in Japan, I got there the day of the show, and I was so nervous. I was so tired. But you know, thankfully we had a great match, which led to me being able to come back. So my second match there, I'm doing a barbed wire bat three-way match against Masato Tanaka and Akira Shoji.
Right up your alley.
Yeah, right. Oh yeah, of course, because I'm very much a deathmatch wrestler. So we're in the back, and the barbed wire bat is sitting there. And I'm thinking I see guys swinging all the time. It's probably going to be really light. And I pick it up, and the thing is heavy. And I'm like, let me check out this barbed wire or whatever. And I touch it, and I poke my finger, and my finger's bleeding. And I was like, this is my first time ever around this type of thing. And I was like, oh, my God, what have I got myself into here?
So do you think this was something done to test you out and see if you're going to be in for the long haul and kind of pay your dues with the company, or did you think they had other ulterior motives?
I think there were other ulterior motives. I think that they were not that they wanted me to replace him, but sort of be similar to a character like a Hayabusa, where I'm able to do pro wrestling matches and maybe do a death match if it comes up.
So after that first one, I don't believe you did many more. So was that an indication they didn't want to continue to put you in that direction, or is that something you decided? So your wrestling is well documented across Japan, Mexico, North America. Something else people may not know about you is you've also dabbled in training. It's something you've been doing professional wrestlers for, I think, now over 10 years. How did you first be approached to be a professional wrestling trainer, which I believe would be with PCW back when it first started? And,
absolutely, yes.
And what can you tell us about how that came about and that first class you had?
Well, you know, I think PCW knew that off the jump, they would get a lot of students inquiring, you know, in front of 1,200, 1,500 people. They knew that, you know, their awareness in the market would be very present. So they started up a school. I mean, they had a millionaire behind it. So there was a building. And, I really think that I may not have been their first choice. And I think that other guys, you know, they didn't really want to do it, who may have been their first choice. But I think based on wrestling ability, there was no one else that they could go to. So I think that's sort of how I got that role.
Is it something you naturally eased into, or is it something that you had to develop a patience for?
I think you definitely have to develop it. And even when I'm not there, I'm thinking of ways, you know, on how to relate things so the trainees understand. It very much takes patience. You know, training people really isn't that easy because you have to explain something in a type of language that they understand and get it. And if they don't get it the first time, then you got to go back to the drawing board and think of how to re-explain it. So it's not as easy as people think.
Especially with a group setting, because you have somebody like a Kenny Omega who's naturally gifted and a lot of things come easy to when they're shown the first time. And then you'll have somebody like myself that took me time and time and time again to get things done. And it was definitely repetition and my trainers going back to the drawing board for me to finally understand that. So when you have different learning abilities and athletic abilities in one class, you kind of have to be all over the place with trying to make sure that everybody's on the same page and progressing at the same time.
Absolutely.
So what can you tell us about that first class that you had?
First class was Antonio Scorpio Jr., Nate Hardy, maybe
Agent Red?
Agent Red, yes. Agent Red was in it. There might have been like one or two other people. You know, what really to say about it? It was Ian Martin dropped out of the class eventually or moved away or something like that. You know, Antonio Scorpio Jr. and Nate Hardy were really the only ones to come out of that class. My brother was actually in that class for a while too.
So that was the first class, and you've trained a few people other, and this is going to be a fun question for me to ask you, because it's something that I know my trainer experienced as well at the time I broke in that, you know, he wasn't happy with, that created a reputation that wasn't necessarily a positive one, is a lot of times people will go into your class, they'll do it for a short period of time, they will quit that class, and they will then go on to find work with another wrestling promotion claiming you're their trainer.
Absolutely.
And that is something that I've heard happen many, many, many times over the years with wrestlers saying they were trained by Mentolo. So right here on the record, who is trained by Mentolo and who's not?
So I'm going to take credit for Kenny Omega because he gives me the credit. So we got Kenny Omega, Antonio Scorpio Jr., Nate Hardy, and Tyler Colton. But Colton gives you credit, Danny. I want you to know that now.
He does not.
He says, I'm trained by the CWE Wrestling Academy, and the second he says, Danny Duggan is my trainer. But those are the ones.
So he's one of those guys going around falsifying their trainer.
Yes, he's one of those guys.
Okay.
So as his trainer, you'll have to have a talk with him.
So is there anyone that comes to mind that you've had to have a talk with that was claiming to be trained by yourself that you said, hey, listen, you didn't finish my class, I'm not endorsing you, please stop?
Well, for instance, Agent Red, he's one of the guys I have to have a talk with. Jan Armstrong, JS McStrongarm. Now, he's done a couple seminars with me. Now, that does not translate to you are fully trained by me. There's a huge difference. Guys are going to the class and stuff all the time, and then I deem them ready. It's like if you go to university and you sit in one or two classes, that doesn't all of a sudden make you a doctor. You know, the university hasn't said, you are finished, now you're a lawyer, now you're a doctor. When they say you're ready, that's when you're ready. So you can't claim, guys, you know, just because you do one or two seminars, which he did, but that doesn't mean that he's trained by me. So he's another one. Who else is there? Tyler Carter. What's his name? TJ Rose. Like, he trained with me a little bit, but then went on to train with ATM and Chevy. So why not give those guys the credit? They spent the time with you. You have to give, you know, whoever is spending the time with you, give them their credit at least. I'm sure there's a ton of other guys. Hump, he was another one. Like, you came down, you trained for a little bit, you spent time with Chevy, you know, flipping off tires and stuff like that. That doesn't mean you're not ready to be in the ring. No one has deemed you, you know, a credible wrestler yet.
And for those that aren't familiar with your classes, you are a very strict and disciplined trainer. So it does take a lot to get through your classes, and a lot of guys can't handle that. So that cycle begins, like I mentioned a few moments ago, where they decide to quit, but I've taken in some of the training. So I'm going to go here and tell them I was trained by this guy who's accredited by the industry and get work as a result.
Exactly.
Recently, you were a part of a promotion called the CNWA. And that was an upstart organization that was short-lived in Western Canada that CWE was involved with. That was, I think, eight companies throughout Western Canada that were branded under one organization with the goal of trying to co-promote professional wrestling across the country. What are your thoughts on your involvement with the CNWA promotion, being a former provincial champion of the company?
Well, it was very, you know, it was very minimal, my interaction with them. You know, being that, you know, we're from Manitoba, the promotion is very much centered around Alberta and BC with a lot of focus on their guys. So it was very tough to get a break. It was very tough to get any work. You know, and a lot of the focus was always on certain people within those companies. You know, and the thing too is that everything is so spaced out in Canada. Like, the big cities are so far apart from each other that it made it very difficult, you know, to even get work out there. So, in theory, it's a good idea, but, you know, it just wasn't very practical in this day and age, I guess.
So you say the focus was on other people within the organization, but you were a feature champion for the organization. How did that come about?
Well, the previous champion wasn't able to fulfill his duties. And so I guess, you know, right place at right time, you know, I was able to relinquish the title from him. But to be honest with you, it didn't really mean very much. A lot of the focus was more on the heavyweight champion or the women's champion. And, you know, even though I was a title holder, it didn't result into any more bookings or any more work within the promotion itself.
Was that strictly due to your location, or was it because of the company being focused on others within the organization?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I mean, I think it was due to my location. You know, maybe it was hard to get me out there. However, I did volunteer my services to stay out and remain in the territory as long as, you know, they could provide work. You know, sort of like how the NWA used to be, like, you know, if you couldn't provide the champion much work, like, he's moving on to somewhere else.
Something that people may not know about you is you have a vision condition, and you already wrestle at a bit of a disadvantage being in a mask. It's something I did a handful of times, and I absolutely hate it because it was impossible to breathe and it was impossible to see. That's something you do already, and then on top of it, you have you know, a condition with your eyes. Tell us a little bit about that and the challenges that presents you, not only being a professional wrestler, but a professional wrestler of your style.
Well, obviously, as you said, you know, the mask sort of hinders your vision, especially like you know, peripheral vision. And I was telling someone recently, like, someone was asking about the mask, and I've said, like, I've had problems. Say if someone goes to extend their hand to shake my hand, like, the line of vision stops at a certain area. So sometimes their hand is extended, and I can't see it. However, when you're in the ring moving around, like, you're not stationary. So obviously, someone extending their hand, you know, you're constantly moving around. You'll see everything. But as you said, yeah, I do have a condition with my eyes. I think it's called keratoconus, where my eyes are sort of shaped like conish. They're not circular as they should be. So eventually, it's going to require new corneas. That's the problem, is that my corneas are shaped like, I guess you could say, like pyramids or pointy at the tips or something like that. So eventually, it'll need to be replaced.
So recently, the big news coming out of Camp Mentolo is you participated in a WWE tryout. How did that come about, and what was your experience like?
You know what? Speaking of WWF, Danny, I was watching Maple Leaf Wrestling from 1985, and Terry Funk threw a dropkick on a concrete floor. I don't remember the wrestler he was wrestling against. But, you know, a lot of people credit Terry Funk with being very hardcore, like whether it was his match in All Japan, you know, against Sheik and Abdullah with his brother Dory, or whether it's the stuff he did in WCW or ECW. But, you know, they don't really mention things that he did in WWF in his first run there. And I just wanted to bring that up to you because I know that you're a connoisseur of DVDs such as myself. And Terry Funk, you know, whether it was the dropkick on the floor or that the headbutt he tried to do through the, or he got slammed on the table in WrestleMania 2. And I think that Terry Funk needs to be recognized for the stuff that he did in WWF as well.
Well, thank you for that. I'll keep my eyes open next time I pop in my DVDs.
Absolutely.
So what can you tell us about this recent experience of yours?
You know, not too much. I know that, you know, in 1985, during one of the body shops, Bret Hart said, and I'm pretty sure that this is the first time that he said that him and Jim Neidhart, the Hart Foundation, are the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be. And I'm pretty sure that's where that phrase started.
You very well could be correct.
Yes, sir.
So I take it this is something we can't talk about at the moment. But I will ask you this. In light of your opportunity that you just received down in Orlando, there were some very controversial comments made on your social media. We're not going to get into those because I have a feeling that's a part of why we can't talk about this subject at the moment. But maybe you can inform us maybe who that was directed at and what brought that on.
Well, you know, like the wrestling scene in Winnipeg, it's very politically driven. And, you know, people, I think when they think they're trying to be helpful, you know, sometimes aren't. And let's say, for instance, Danny, you're at the gym, and I see that you're doing bicep curls improperly. Now, instead of me just telling you, Danny, you're doing those curls improperly, why don't I take the time to say, hey, you know, you're doing them improperly, but here's an idea of how to do them differently, and try to be helpful more than anything else. I think a lot of guys think they're being helpful when really they're hurting situation more than anything else. And if I don't know how to do bicep curls, if I don't know how to do them properly, I probably shouldn't criticize how you're doing them.
That analogy makes perfect sense to me, and I'm sure it does to the listener at home.
I hope so.
So kind of based off that, we've only got a few minutes remaining here. We talked about a lot of, let's have some fun now. We've talked about some of the great opponents you wrestled in your 17-year career. Let's talk about some of the worst opponents you've ever had. Who are some of the worst people you've ever been in the ring with and some of the worst matches you have ever had?
You know what? Some of the worst matches I ever had. First one that comes to mind was a horrible, horrible match I had with J.C. Durson at Chalmers. Wow, was that a brutal match. And I'm sure if you ask him, he'll tell you the same thing.
And why was this one in particular so bad?
Everything was off. Like, there was no chemistry between us. I don't know. Like, he was doing this gimmick, I guess, where he was coming out to Sesame Street music and stuff like that. Like, I don't know what it was, but it just did not translate properly, and it was just a horrible match.
So J.C. Dirksen gets the nod as the worst opponent in Mentolo's 17-year career. I want to go into, with the last few minutes we have here, a section I call Ribs, Rats, and Road Stories with Mentolo. You can combine them or you can separate those categories, but I would like to hear a good story from the road regarding ribs or rats from Mentolo.
Holy cow, ribs or rats.
Or preferably both. I think the viewer at home would be entertained by both of those subjects being covered.
Oh, man. I wish you had told me this earlier. I would have tried to, like, have a good story ready.
You've just had so many, it's hard to pick one out.
Ribs. Oh, man. Jeez, I can't think of anything right now.
You're a good friend of Donnie DiCaprio, who's known for pulling pranks. None of those come to mind?
You know what, like, one of my favorite things about DiCaprio and Omega is being in battle royals with them. Because, you know, a lot of guys, you know, they take their spot, and as well you should, I guess, as well you should, take your spot in a battle royal, very serious. But, you know, guys feel like, you know, they need to be in there right till the end and stuff like that. And DiCaprio and Omega, they're not having it when they're in there with you. And they will go over and throw guys out any which way they can, any which way possible. And however you land is however you land. And if your hands, like, guys will hang on for dear life, and they will peel each finger back just like in a movie. And if you're going over head first, like, that's your break, buddy. Tough. So there's some of my favorite guys to be in battle royals with, because you're going out regardless. And they'll kick you, they'll stomp you, anything to get you out.
So as we close out the show here, we'll end it with a very simple question. What's next for Mentolo?
That's a great question. What is next for Mentolo? Well, next up, Robbie Royce is the CWE champion. And I think that he's held it for quite long enough. You know, ATM is a champion too, and I think he's held it for quite long enough. And Tommy Lee Curtis recently pinned me for the tag team titles. And, maybe if myself and Tyler Colton can get on the same page, maybe that might be something in my future as well.
So you've got gold in your sights.
I sure do, Danny, sure do.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you as my first. You broke me in gently.
Interracial, like a panda.
Like a panda. So thank you very much for being involved in the first episode of Elite Wrestling Radio. I think we just scratched the surface. I think we have a lot more to cover with you, so we'll definitely have you back on sometime soon.
Absolutely. I'd love to come back. I hope the fans aren't bored or sleeping through this interview. If they have any questions or anything like that, let me know to Danny. Maybe he'll answer them.
Let me know if you get any hate mail.
I will for sure.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Take care.
And that's it for a first edition of Elite Wrestling Radio. Thank you for sticking with us for a fabulous interview with CWE's own Mentolo. We'll be back here next week. Stay tuned. We're going to have another great guest on next Wednesday night.